Well, Marxists have a scientific and precise definition of exploitation, and it comes complete with algebraic formulas about surplus value and constant capital. But the Marxist definition of oppression is not so precise. The oppression that people suffer under capitalism is not as simple to measure or quantify, yet it is essential to capitalist rule as wage labour and profit. Now, small-L liberals tend to see oppression as being mostly or entirely a matter of the denial of individual rights, lack of equality of opportunity, unfair treatment by the law, and so on. And these are crucial aspects of oppression. The fact that same-sex partners cannot marry each other, that young women today will earn $1 million less over their lifetimes than men, that primary school kids think that Muslims are terrorists or that it's okay to hit women. These are all vile, cruel aspects of capitalist society. But why do they occur and how do we stop them? The liberal answer begins and ends in the realm of ideas. Homophobic discrimination is seen as coming from bigoted politicians or religious leaders, racism as stemming from ignorance, and so on. From this starting point, it makes sense to put enormous financial and personal resources into education campaigns, lobbying, awareness raising, and other strategies aimed at changing the minds of those who hold racist or sexist ideas. So while we are active and strident campaigners alongside many liberals to change all oppressive laws and win as many gains as possible under capitalism, we continue to argue that, you know, simply closing detention centres and giving out visas will not be the end of anti-immigrant racism. Winning gay marriage rights will not end homophobia, bashings and suicide amongst LGBTIQ people. There's too many acronyms there. As for sexism, there are very few actually discriminatory laws remaining. It can seem as though women do have full formal equality with men. So something far more powerful than mere laws obviously drives oppression and the attitudes and ideologies that back it up. Now, you will find many liberals, academics, bureaucrats, lawyers, intellectuals, who can agree that oppression is a systemic problem. But these seemingly more left-wing critiques can actually be the more disarming, as they locate oppression not as Marxists do within the real class structure and class struggle of capitalist society, but to something literally supernatural or superhuman. Discourse, patriarchy, cultural imperialism, or a supposedly eternal and universal human nature. And if oppression derives from something so amorphous and all-pervasive, then what is the point of trying to change it? The only logical response would be to adapt to it, to carve out spaces, sometimes intellectual, sometimes physical, and try to be as separate as possible from the oppressive reality, separate indeed from other oppressed groups. And this is exactly what we have seen with the rise of identity politics, separatism, accommodation to the system after the decline of the mighty liberation movements of the 60s and early 70s. Logically, intellectually, these theories fall into the same kind of error as ideas that seek to explain the world's problems on the basis of sin or the backward prejudices of powerful individuals. They endow ideas with the same motive power as people or the forces of nature. Now, in the Marxist approach, ideas form part of a worldview that also includes, for example, the degree of economic development of a society, the relative strength of different classes and nations within a world system, and the recent and long-term history of the struggles between these groups. For Marxists, the immediate content of an idea is not nearly so significant as the interests that it serves, who holds it, when in history it first appeared, and what changes it has undergone over time. At base, Marxist theory asserts that the ideological framework of a given society reflects the way that people in that society live. We start from, as Marx and Engels wrote in the German ideology, not arbitrary premises, not dogmas, but real individuals, their activity and the material conditions of their life, both those which they find already existing and those produced by their activity. Thus, the first fact to be established is the physical organisation of these individuals and their consequent relation to the rest of society. So, if a Marxist wants to find out why three monotheistic religions arose at similar times from the same place in the Middle East, she doesn't rely on the stories those religions tell about their origins. She doesn't look just at what the rulers of those societies had to say about it either. She will start by investigating the way that people got their food, shelter, basic needs in those societies. She will find out how the ruling class obtained their surplus from an exploited majority. She will look at the pressures on those societies to change or develop in certain directions, for example, towards agriculture or because of wars. She will look at the ideas that were displaced, the deities and the ideas that were displaced by the idea of there being one all-powerful God, and which groups in society held the different ideas. Now, all of Marx's theory is based on this approach. It's sometimes known as dialectical materialism or historical materialism or simply the dialectic. And these terms are often talked about in hushed tones as though dialectics is a secret Marxist religion or some arcane philosophical oddity. But I think it gets its reputation for being difficult to understand simply because it is the very opposite of the capitalist modes of explaining the world. For example, at school, we're taught subjects all cut up from each other. Maths supposedly has nothing to do with history. Art seemingly has nothing to do with biology. Language is taught as though it has nothing to do with anything at all. In the daily news, crime, politics, business news, wars, and celebrity lifestyles are all fed to us as soundbites unconnected with each other. Each branch of science is encouraged by the dominance of the military and corporate funding of research to specialise ever more narrowly and just with an eye to what can be sold or patented or profited from. Now, the word dialectic just means, and this is, you know, just from the Macquarie Dictionary, a process of change that results from an interplay between opposite tendencies. That means that instead of seeing the world as a whole mess of unconnected catastrophes, we can approach it as a differentiated totality. A totality that is constantly changing. Now, Marx and Engels were by no means the first thinkers to use the dialectical model to understand the world, but their crucial breakthrough was to make it a materialist method, to locate the impetus for change within human structures and human societies, not in human rationality, an eternal human spirit, still less in God or a higher power. For Marxists, the constant change that we see around us in the totality of the world and social systems occurs due to the pressures and contradictions between the different parts of life, the different forces and relations in the natural and social worlds. And one brief example to illustrate this process could be, on the one hand, the ideology of the stay-at-home wife and mother, which was developed by capitalism for a specific purpose during the 1800s, and on the other hand, the increasing need for capitalism to employ married women and mothers throughout the 20th century. Capitalism needs women's oppression to function, and the ideology of woman as mother and homemaker is a crucial plank in that, but capitalism's own requirements for our labour create a contradiction that ultimately gives more power to women to fight sexism and help to give rise to the women's liberation movement. Of course, it's not just the contradictions of capitalist society which should be analysed materially or dialectically. Today, I want to spend some time on the historical and scientific questions of human nature, the origins of humanity and class society, and what these can tell us about whether women have always been oppressed. Because pretty much everyone from the Pope down to members of your family to feminist columnists and comedians and university lecturers will talk about or subscribe to some version of the following. Men and women are just fundamentally different. You know, there's just an enormous gulf. And that's the way it's been since the dawn of time. Just think about the caveman days, you know, when the man would go out with a big stick, bash a woman over the head and drag her by the hair back to their cave, which miraculously resembles a kind of a, you know, a kind of a white picket fence except with a cave style, yeah. And this is just part of nature. Just look at the male aggression in nature amongst baboons and lions and dung beetles or whatever it might be, okay? I may be maligning the dung beetles there. They probably have a very egalitarian society. Now, if this was true, this is not just a bleak picture of human nature. It makes the possibility of women's liberation doubtful. So it is vital for socialists to be able to discuss these issues and confidently answer people's doubts. Now, it was Marx's lifelong collaborator, Engels, who mapped out the dialectical and materialist approach to these questions. And, in fact, the Marxist method actually gave Engels a theoretical edge on Charles Darwin when it came to proposing a possible evolutionary path for humanity. Despite the enormity of his contribution, Darwin's reluctance to challenge the dominant cultural and intellectual emphasis on rational thought as the motor of cultural change meant that he argued that apes first developed a much more bigger brain and then started to walk upright. And a century of you know, archaeological, paleontological science was wasted in trying to find the missing link, a fossil ape with a large brain. Now, in his book, The Part Played by Labour in the Transition from Ape to Man, Engels had argued that a more terrestrial lifestyle among apes should have first encouraged greater use of the hand, you know, which he described as the first tool, and then more sophisticated tool use and tool making, and a corresponding evolutionary selection towards individuals and groups with greater manual dexterity, which in turn tended to support bipedalism, that's walking upright, and the complex social tasks and social labour which gave rise to a need to communicate, to language, and thus in turn to the distinctive brain development which is a feature of the human species. And it was not until 1974 when a complete 3.5 million-year-old fossil skeleton with an erect posture and an ape-like brain was discovered that Darwin's proposed sequence of development was finally abandoned and archaeologists could begin to explain the evolution of one set of skeletons to another. Now, the only hard evidence available to us about the period between, you know, 2 to 3 million years ago when these developments were occurring is limited to fossils, you know, bones, teeth, stone tools, and scientists have to try and work out from that things like the development of the soft organs, larynx, language, brain size, all those kinds of things. Consequently, it's not possible to be definitive about the status of women during these times. But the evidence about developing human capabilities and patterns of life that can be deduced strongly suggest against a theory of a species born from blood, that humans became the dominant species of primate because of our bloody, murderous and cruel nature. On the contrary, what is quite clear from the fossil evidence is that by as early as 1.6 million years ago, Homo erectus, in other words, the creature that, well, the person or creature that was before our species, Homo sapiens, had already lost traits which are common amongst the apes, such as long fangs, males of the species being twice as large as the females, you know, for defence. Other important changes included the imposable thumb, it's obviously crucial for manual dexterity, a much longer maturing time for infants, and female sexual interest no longer being confined to 1 or 2 days around ovulation. In other words, these early humans were relying on something quite other than brute strength or the ability to just kill or swiftly flee to succeed in their ecological niche, something that is now widely understood by, you know, a whole range of scientists to be social cooperation, social labour, the flexibility to move and change, shift environments and develop new ways of doing things. So to sum up this section, humans are not separate from the natural world, but neither are we simply naked apes that are at the mercy of genetic imperatives or animalistic survival instincts. Human consciousness and our special abilities to collectively shape and change our natural environment make us distinct from the rest of nature. Now, we're on much more solid ground when it comes to a theory of how class developed and, alongside it, women's oppression. Marxists argue that women's oppression was unknown in early societies because there was no social stratification or social class. And the evidence for this claim comes not from fossils, but from extensive studies of hundreds of societies around the world that were living without class and women's oppression as recently as 80 to 200 years ago. These kinds of societies have so many features in common that they are thought to give a reliable guide to how humans living tens of thousands of years ago might have organised their lives. And there are broadly two kinds of societies that are discussed: hunter-gatherer societies, or also known as foraging societies, and societies based on horticulture and herding animals, pastoral societies. And certain observations are common of every foraging or hunter-gathering society studied. Such societies are organised around fairly small, flexibly organised groups or bands of 30 to 40 people, which may periodically get together in gatherings of several hundreds. The social traits which are valued by foraging bands are reciprocity, generosity, and modesty. There are people who exercise leadership in such groupings and whose opinions may carry more weight in group discussions, but as anthropologist Richard Lee recorded of the Kung people in southern Africa, whatever their skills, Kung people have no formal authority. They can only persuade but never enforce their will on others. None is arrogant, overbearing, boastful or aloof. In Kung terms, these traits absolutely disqualify a person as a leader. Another trait emphatically not found among traditional camp leaders is a desire for wealth or acquisitiveness. Differentiation of roles according to sex is common in these kinds of societies, but not to the extent or with the consequences that are popularly thought. That is to say, as a rule, men often do most of the hunting. But most of the food consumed by a band comes from gathering, which is, you know, more associated with the role of the women. And in fact, for large hunting expeditions, it was quite common for the whole band, including women and children, to work together to chase, trap, steer and trap an animal. Children were looked after by the band as a whole. But most importantly, differences in roles between women and men did not translate to differences in status. Women exercised autonomy over their day-to-day activities and had an equal say with the men on issues affecting the whole band, such as where and when to move camp. And these bands are also characterised by the loose and flexible nature of the groupings within them. Couples can separate suddenly, or bands separate into different groupings without this problem causing problems for a group's livelihood. And what's more, warfare is uncommon among such societies, and where it occurs, it tends to be in a highly ritualised form. Disputes are not unknown, but they are of marginal importance. And as you'd be aware, in this country, Aboriginal groups had responsibility for or belonged to certain specific areas of country, but this did not mean that other groups could never come onto each other's land. Relics from the Kimberley region have been found at Byron Bay, which was a historic gathering place, and greenstone axes made by the Wurundjeri at Mount William near Lancefield here in Victoria have been found traded as far afield as northern South Australia. Now, this egalitarian lifestyle is sometimes known as primitive communism, and it can only be understood materially, you know, not by saying, again, you know, Marxists are not at this point saying, well, this proves that there is a universal human nature, but that it's really generous or, you know, reciprocal or something like that. No. To understand it, you have to look at the material basis of the foraging societies, what they had to do to live on the land. They needed to move around in small groups, changing places according to the season or as food resources became exhausted. The need to move regularly precluded the build-up of material wealth. All that people owned was what could be carried from place to place. The emphasis on reciprocity and generosity reflects the fact that each member of a band was intensely dependent on the others for day-to-day survival. And the egalitarian nature of society, you know, the dislike of authority and so forth, reflected the flexible compositions of the bands. You know, there's no percentage in someone trying to dominate others that, you know, that just doesn't fit with how they get their day-to-day living. Now, we can't simply read off from the lifestyles and customs of surviving hunter-gatherer societies exactly how our ancient forebears might have organised their lives, because we have no way of knowing how much their practices have been impacted by neighbouring agricultural societies over thousands of years or by the pressures of industrial capitalism more recently, although there are plenty of studies about that particular impact on hunter-gatherer societies. But the basic elements of sharing, cooperation and flexible social organisation we can be confident were universal and they were in fact carried through into the early agricultural societies that started to develop from these bands. Around 10,000 years ago, changes in production started to influence different modes of life. What is often referred to as the Neolithic Revolution or the New Stone Age. Groups of people in several different parts of the world independently found ways or developed ways of cultivating and storing food. The increased productivity of these societies meant a more settled existence, and for the first time it made sense to build permanent dwellings and to make things like large heavy vessels for storing grain in. Animals started to be domesticated and herded during this period. The basis of production shifted from total interdependence among all members of a small group to larger populations with production based around individual households combined with larger collective works as populations increased. It has often been assumed that the shift to agriculture was desired by peoples because it meant a higher standard of living. However, this has been shown not to be the case. There are plenty of hunter-gatherer societies that have existed alongside agricultural communities for thousands of years and explicitly rejected the settled way of life as it was identified with an unacceptable increase in hard labour. Analyses of the diet of foraging groups, even in seemingly arid desert areas, have shown that they can have a higher calorific intake of food than neighbouring settled peoples for much less daily work. So why did agriculture develop? We can speculate on some reasons. The ability to cultivate crops and animals was practiced by all kinds of Aboriginal groups here in Victoria, for example, some of whom built stone houses and other semi-permanent dwellings while still moving around seasonally to take advantage, for example, of the coastal eel harvests of early spring. And this also occurred in several different parts of the world. In a sense, many such communities combined hunter-gatherer existence, albeit in larger populations, with the convenience of naturally fertile resources and lands. But what if climatic conditions changed or the resources dried up after hundreds or even thousands of years of more settled living? Then such groups faced a hard choice. Break up again into small wandering groups and try and relearn the survival skills of foragers, or apply the techniques of crop and herd cultivation more systematically, even if that involved an intensification of work. And, you know, the evidence is that, you know, in certain places groups went both ways. Some did go back to the foraging lifestyle. But in places that didn't, the change to a more settled lifestyle necessitated changes in the social structure. Big disputes within a group could no longer be settled by the group splitting or people leaving. In these societies, family groups or lineages became the key means of social organisation. Now, if you've read or you plan to read The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State by Engels, he uses a whole series of different terms in that book, but lineage is the modern accepted anthropological term for this, you know, kin organisation. In these horticultural and pastoral societies, there were much tighter rules specifying who had responsibilities to whom, who was related to whom, who could marry whom, such that if a person or their household experienced crop failure, there was an understood network of family ties to ensure that no one went hungry, lineage ties. So in this way, the tighter lineage organisation codified the egalitarianism that had been a sort of a naturally occurring basis of the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. And Engels described his readings about the Iroquois, a group that was a horticultural group, the people that lived in New York State and surrounding areas. He wrote, "Everything runs smoothly without soldiers, gendarmes or police, without nobles, kings, governors, prefects or judges, without prisons, without trials. All quarrels and disputes are settled by the whole body of those concerned. Households are run in common by a number of families. There can be no poor and needy. All are free or equal, including the women." So it's clearly, you know, we're talking about societies in which there is not social stratification, social class, or what we would identify as women's oppression. Some other changes were important. The rise of warfare. Wealth that could be stored was now wealth that could be taken by force, you know, or plundered. So warfare became more a common feature of these societies. And this new form of social organisation made it possible, indeed desirable, for women to bear children more frequently than in a foraging society. In those societies, the need for small children to be carried around for the early years of their life typically meant that children were spaced some years apart, either through sexual abstention, abortion or infanticide. However, in the more labour-intensive pastoral horticultural lifestyle, it made sense for the whole society for there to be more children. Many hunter-gatherer and horticultural societies that have been studied were matrilineal or matrilocal, in which descent was either reckoned down the female line so that a man's most important family ties were not to his own children, but to his sister's children, or in which a man on marriage moved from his mother's or uncle's household to that of his wife and her sisters and mother. There were societies in which the women moved or in which descent was reckoned patrilineally, but this still did not result in the lower status of women. A woman was still an important productive member of society upon her marriage, an important person in her own lineage with whom her husband's lineage had important links to maintain. In no sense were women owned by their male partners. Instead, what we're seeing is a social world in which both men and women were tied into a network of mutual rights and responsibilities. That's the social content of the lineage kin organisation. Now, over time, certain households or lineages did become more influential or were able to control more resources in their society, whether through luck or superior skill in cultivation or success in warfare. However, in most horticultural or pastoral societies, this still did not translate into the leading families being able to control the labour or resources of others. In fact, the old values of reciprocity and generosity meant that such, you know, chiefs, leading families, you know, big men or whatever, had to give more, provide more, and work harder than others in society in proportion with their status. Thus, among the New Guinea Bosama, the clubhouse leader has to work harder than anyone else to keep up his stocks of food. He must toil early and late. His hands are never free from earth and his forehead continually drips with sweat. Nevertheless, you can see that there are contradictions inherent in this mode of production which can help to explain why some of these societies developed into class societies. There is a tension between the forces of production, which has now become individual households, and the relations of production, the lineages which codify the reciprocity, the marriage rules, the interdependence. At first, prestige within a society was gained by redistribution of a surplus in line with the old egalitarian rules and values. But the existence of the surplus opened the door for it to turn into a source of power. But the question must be answered: why would people accept a change from egalitarian lineage-based societies to class societies in which the labour of the majority props up a non-productive and increasingly exploitative ruling class? There are a few points to emphasise in answer. As populations grew larger, the possible surpluses grew bigger. Warfare and plunder make more sense and play more of a role. Trade developed. Larger agricultural populations meant more specialisation amongst populations and spurred some crucial technical developments: metal smelting, metal working, the plough. As technical advances continued to increase the productive capacity of society, villages gave way to towns and eventually to the first cities. It would make sense to people that some people should start to be freed from the direct daily labour of reproducing life to administer and oversee the social product, to plan and supervise large collective projects such as building irrigation channels or making war. Over this time, there was a shift in religious forms from spirits to gods, and some have suggested that gods may be seen as a projection of the community and its social existence. Thus, the priests who served the gods could claim to be, and could indeed be intended by the rest of society, as servants of the community. And this is the group in societies such as, you know, ancient Mesopotamia in ancient Iraq that developed alphabets and writing. And it's noteworthy that the only existing documents, written documents, older than 4,800 years ago, are account tables. Thus, writing, which today we consider to be a hallmark of, you know, civilization, arose directly out of the need to monitor a social surplus. The earliest temples in the earliest known class society, that of Mesopotamia, were the granaries that symbolised the strength and wealth of the whole society, and that were watched over by the priests. And this was the layer that in that society then became the first ruling class. Now, a group that was able to use its prestige, whether through control of the surplus, success in warfare, or religious authority, to organise the rest of society to increase production, could come to see itself as embodying the interests of society as a whole. In times of crisis or scarcity, it could see its own survival, even at the expense of others, as necessary for the future of society. But emerging ruling classes could not keep control of a social surplus in times of hardship without finding ways of imposing their will, without creating such mechanisms of social control as standing armies, religious and legal codes, and the ideologies to back them up. They created oppression and exploitation. And while nascent ruling classes must have been a spur to social advance, you know, in times of plenty or in times when they were organising and increasing the production of society, the mechanisms they created to protect their rule could persist, you know, and would persist as methods of social control beyond their usefulness in advancing production. And thus was created a new and crucial contradiction that has defined human existence ever since: class struggle. Now, the question remains why women were the losers. What was it in the development of class society that led to the world historic defeat of the female sex, as Engels so memorably termed it? We've already looked at one important change between small bands of hunter-gatherers and the shift to settled horticulture and agriculture, which is the greater social need for more population and more children. And we have already seen that there were some roles which were different between women and men, without that meaning women had a lower status. There is an interplay between the development of wealth and productivity in the agricultural societies, and particularly the ones that became class societies, and the different roles of the different sexes. In the early stages of the agricultural revolution, the evidence suggests that many of the key advances were the work of women, as described by the socialist archaeologist Gordon Child in the 50s. He wrote, "To women must be credited discovering suitable plants and appropriate methods for their cultivation, devising special implements for tilling the soil, reaping and sowing the crops and converting it into food, the chemistry of pot making, the physics of spinning, the mechanics of the loom, and the botany of flax and cotton." And many of the tasks that men were more likely to do throughout, you know, what we know about history, were the ones that involved potential risk to pregnant women or infants. But those tasks were the ones which, over time, created crucial elements of the social surplus out of which grew the basis for class rule: warfare, long-distance trade, stock-keeping and animal herding over long distances. The invention of the plough, drawn by animals, shifted agriculture away from women too. Even in recent times, in contact between capitalist societies and pre-capitalist societies, the societies in which agriculture was still done by hoe and digging stick tended to be the ones associated with women's higher status, women's central role in production, whereas the ones that are based on the plough, pulled by an animal, traditionally, you know, a male area of responsibility, are ones that have been associated with, you know, women's oppression, class rule, and the lower status of women. So women's productive role in society could be less significant at the same time as their reproductive responsibilities were becoming more dominant, and through a period of social development when social production and the production of the surplus was becoming a source of power to a minority of men. And alongside this, running parallel to this, the lineages, the kin-based lineages which organised society in many cases through the female side of the family, were being weakened as the interdependent communal social values they represented were being overthrown by a new form of social organisation based on control of a social surplus. So although most men in society obviously didn't become rulers, within households, as the capacity and the responsibility for production shifted away from women to the tasks that men did, it would make sense to stop building households around the female line and start looking to descent through the male line as a key to a family's survival. But I think the important question to understand, the important point to understand when answering the question of why people accepted class society, why people accepted this change in women's status, is that these developments took place so slowly over periods of hundreds, even thousands of years, that Engels was right to argue both that this revolution, you know, this change, you know, in the status of women, was one of the most decisive ever experienced by mankind, but also that it need not have disturbed one single living member of a society. Now, ancient Mesopotamia, which is now, you know, the area covered by Iraq and so forth, was one of the earliest and has been the most extensively studied societies to develop a class structure. But class rule arose independently in at least eight other parts of the world, including China, the Andes, several parts of Africa, and the Indus Valley, in periods from 500 to as recently as 1,000 years ago. For the societies that adopted class rule, it came out of factors that no one individual or grouping created. Yet, it gave the societies that developed in this way an advantage. They came to dominate. That meant that everything about the new class societies came to dominate, not just their productive techniques or their technological breakthroughs, but the whole panoply of social control, oppression, and exploitation. The vast majority of societies around the world did not move to class rule through their own internal contradictions, but through the impact of neighbouring class societies, through trade, military defeat, or colonisation. And henceforward, the history of all societies was indeed the history of class struggle. Now, I want to move to a conclusion now by discussing the exact interaction between oppression and class, because I find that oppression is a term almost exclusively used by comrades to differentiate between economic and non-economic aspects of capitalist rule. And in this sense, the word oppression is often used as a synonym for racism, sexism, and homophobia. And in branch meetings, these terms are also often used as though they mainly refer to the prejudiced ideas that some workers hold. But this is not very satisfactory or a very dynamic conception of capitalist rule. What we can see from the Marxist account of the origins of class indicates a key fact about oppression, that it is necessary for exploitation, indispensable for any ruling class, and therefore totally bound up with the economics of capitalist profit-taking. Marx, in Volume 3 of Capital, drew the link. The specific economic form in which unpaid surplus labour is pumped out of the direct producers determines the relationship between those who dominate and those who are in subjection, the political form of the relations of sovereignty and dependence. So you have societies based on slave labour, serfdom, colonisation, apartheid, peasants forcibly driven off their land to become a new industrial working class, all examples of oppression. But even today, in all developed countries, all workers are oppressed as workers. We do not choose to sell our labour power, our human ingenuity and our capabilities for the vast majority of lives to capitalists of our own free will. We are compelled to do this because we have no other way of feeding and sheltering ourselves. We are born without any other means of sustaining our lives. And our lives are worthless with no intrinsic meaning or dignity, except insofar as we are employable and useful to the capitalist system. If we are too inexperienced, too old, our qualifications are not right, our skills are no longer in demand, we're no longer useful commodities to the system with life-threatening consequences to us. Unemployment, poverty, devastation, murder, suicide, domestic violence, in a word, oppression, so fundamental that it distorts our personal and sexual lives so that we are unable to interact with each other as free human beings. The fact that the vast wealth of society is locked away for the profits and private consumption of a tiny parasitic minority leads to further oppression of the working class. We're not involved democratically or have the political power over decisions that affect the whole of our lives. So look at the rest of the conditions of our life, of working class life. Schools that are poorly resourced, understaffed, where unruly students are put in mini detention centres and threatened with expulsion until they learn to conform. Hospitals where people die on trolleys and give birth in toilets. Aged care facilities where our elders sit in urine and eat rubbish. Childcare where the staff are paid less than cleaners and they cost so much it's not even worth getting a job sometimes. Non-existent public transport, two-hour commutes to work, a constant barrage of propaganda that we are the ones that have to take shorter showers, not grow gardens, give up our sports facilities, turn down the heating, or stop driving our cars to save the planet. Police harassment of young people, working-class young people, not to mention drinkers, you know, drunk workers, so-called hoons, bikies, and other non-compliant groups of workers. This is the context in which we need to see the additional forms of oppression that capitalism has created, and to see first and foremost how they also serve the needs of exploitation. For example, in holding down wages by increasing competition between workers, or by upholding institutions like the family, which is absolutely vital to the functioning of the system. When we say that racism or sexism or other forms of oppression divide the working class, we want to be explaining that in terms of the racist, sexist society that the ruling class has created through exploitation and oppression. And not just sort of using this as shorthand for saying that if workers have racist or sexist ideas, they'll find it harder to win strikes. That's true. But to the extent that workers accept divisive ideas or reformist ideas or pro-capitalist ideas for that matter, such consciousness is a product of the really oppressive class society. And while this never stops us arguing against these ideas and trying to convince people out of them, whilst ever we live under capitalism, we have to recognise that there will be a material basis for such oppressive ideas. But I'll just finish by saying that one feature of capitalism that has never before been seen in human history gives us the material basis for hope, you know, for hope to change the system. And that is the fact that it is the precise nature of our oppression as workers, as I described, of being stripped of anything except the ability to work collectively, democratically on the, you know, instruments of our oppression. That is the basis that for the first time in history can give rise to a new form of social organisation, a new form of communism, not primitive communism this time, a communism that can be based on abundance and not subsistence.